The argument I'm going to make with you is that since reality is intelligible, able to be understood, even if we can't do it, it makes sense. It's not absurd, it's not stupid, it's intelligible. If that's true, that reality is intelligible, the argument is that there must exist God. If there is no God, the ultimate meaning of things isn't there. It's unintelligible. It's ultimately absurd. The Catechism speaks of converging and convincing arguments for the existence of God. That's number 31. Quote, "These can predispose a person to faith and help us see that faith is not opposed to reason," which is a wonderful thing to see. Reason can't attain it all, but it's not unreasonable to believe. In fact, I want to prove to you today that it's unreasonable not to believe. These arguments are not proofs in the mathematical or scientific sense, nor should we look for such proofs. Most of our human experiences lie outside the range of the empirical sciences. Karl Rahner writes, "The natural scientists should constantly accept theology's reminder that the worldview, which is actually a part of their lives, and not just something conceived by the monopolistic claims of the natural scientists, is something which cannot be determined by their natural science alone. That spirit, freedom, fidelity, love, and the infinite question of existence cannot be explained by natural science alone. They're not geared to it. They're not geared to be able to establish the ultimate meaning of things. They're geared to measure and predict and all the rest that you people know so well from your empirical sciences. So the methods of empirical science are unsatisfactory when it comes to the questions that we're now asking. If we examine our experience, and you do this for yourself as you listen, we realize that there are many things that we know without being able to demonstrate the truth of what we know in such a way as to convince others, especially if they don't want to be convinced. Have you ever had this problem with your teenage children, or your spouse, or your mother or father, or your priest, or... As the Catechism makes clear, arguments for the existence of God don't demand consent. I'm aware of some of the complexes. 2 and 2 equals 4 doesn't require a big argument, though I understand it does in certain mathematical ways. So leave me alone on that. But some things are so obvious, your mind has to say, of course, that's it. But not here. Openness to the transcendent requires self-surrender. If we're open to mystery and willing to surrender ourselves to love, we can come to see that the world as we know it makes sense only if God exists. It's a further step to what I was saying earlier about objectivity is authentic subjectivity. If you're an authentic subject, willing to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible, and believe, if you make that choice to live your life like that, you will come to discover a whole lot of things. If you don't make those choices, you won't discover them. And they won't impact on your mind and demand consent, because you're either too lazy, or too occupied, or too distracted, or too uninterested in the ultimate meaning of things, that you just live from day to day. So we're not going to have our mind say, oh, of course, only a saint will be saying, of course. Intelligent inquiry leads to the insight that God exists. You've got to test this for yourself later when you get more time, but it's time to make a point that is of the most profound significance. Over and over again, we learn that our inquiring mind is connecting with reality. That's what I did last week. We keep finding we're in touch with the real. Again and again, we find answers to our questions. If something is happening, we simply take it for granted that there is a reason. Sometimes we manage to work out the reason, other times the reason evades us. But we never doubt that there is a reason. In other words, we take it for granted that reality is intelligible. The whole of our life experience, including the marvelous success of science, reinforces the correctness of approaching reality as ultimately intelligible. The whole university is about this. This happened. Why did it happen? We presume there's a reason. There has to be some reason. And we may not find it, but we pursue it in whatever methodology is appropriate to our scientific endeavour. Car breaks down. It didn't just break down, for God's sake. There's something wrong. We take that for granted. We know it's true. We connect. Then we may not find out what's wrong, but then you get a bloke in from the NRMA who certainly finds out. But there is a reason for the breakdown. It's not just random event. However, when we ask the big question, not everyone asks it. How come this being exists? That's the question I want to put to you this morning. How come you exist? How come I exist? The beings that we experience, including ourselves, don't provide a satisfactory answer. I know that you exist. With the help of some knowledge of your history plus some elementary biology, I can come to know why you came into being. But when I ask how it is that you are now existing, I don't find the answer in knowing you. You don't provide the answer. It's a fact that you are, but there was a time when you weren't. You don't have within yourself a satisfactory explanation of your own being. If you did, you would exist not just in fact, but necessarily. Of course, you exist because you're Peter. Well, if you exist because you're Peter, why didn't you exist 1,000 years ago? If I want a fully satisfying explanation of your existing now, not coming to be, but existing, I have to look outside you. However, this is the key to the point I'm making, wherever I look, I come up against the same problem. Everything I know exists, like you, in fact, but not necessarily. It is, to use the technical word, contingent. I've learnt to trust that my inquiring mind does connect me with reality. So there's a reason to inquire, it's intelligent to inquire, and there is a reason for your existing now. You don't explain it. No one around you explains it. The Big Bang doesn't explain it. Because all of these things are contingent realities. This is one of Thomas Aquinas' key arguments. I think it's a fine one. You are, so there must exist an explanation. Something accounts for the fact that I exist now. What is it? The only conclusion I suggest that we can draw is that there must exist here and now a being that lies outside the limits of my experience and knowledge. A being that does not require an explanation outside itself for its existence. A being that exists not only in fact, but necessarily, by virtue of what that being is. It has to be. Since it contains within itself a fully satisfactory explanation of its existence. The ultimate explanation for the existence of contingent being, being all the created world we know, is the existence of a necessarily existing being. It is this necessarily existing being that we call God. That God exists is something we know, if my argument is intact. The ultimate intelligibility of being, reason and logic, requires the existence of this being. However, God, the name, is not an object of direct experience or knowledge. We can't form comprehensive concepts of God, and I'll spend more time on that momentarily, for the being that must exist if what we know has meaning, this being transcends the capacity of the human mind to know. We can't experiment with it. God is not another object among all of many objects that we're looking at. That God exists is the conclusion of an intelligent mind demanding meaning. But God necessarily remains mysterious because we're incapable of comprehending the mystery. That's the existence of God. How we conceive God, when I use the word God, what comes into your mind, or anybody's mind, that is a matter of belief, not knowledge. I'll talk for myself, but I hope I'm talking for you. I'm unable to give an accurate account of the images and concepts that I associated with the word God when I was a child. As a child, I believed many things that I outgrew. I believed, for example, in the existence of Santa Claus. However, when I came to the point of asking my parents whether Santa Claus actually exists, they knew I was ready to leave the magical world of childhood and hear the truth. I also believed that Adam and Eve were real people who started off the human race. It wasn't until much later that I came to realize that the account in the Bible is a story, not a factual account. The truths conveyed by the story are profound, but they're not on the level of fact. As for God, it wasn't until I became aware of the existence of atheists and of the many ways in which different cultures imagine God that I had to question whether there is a God. And if so, how should I think of this God? As a child, I never asked such questions, for God was central to the view of life into which I was socialized, acculturated, educated in our family and in the life of our local parish and school. When in my late teens, and this may be true for you too, I looked into the question of God, I realized that to deny the existence of a being that is the ultimate cause of everything that exists, an idea expressed in the notion of creator, is to conclude that everything I know, including myself, is ultimately meaningless. This struck me, and still strikes me, as a rejection of what I know about myself as an inquiring being, and a partial but obvious success of sustained inquiry. Science is a standout example of successful inquiry and discovery of the truth, and we're forever growing in our knowledge of the human psyche and of communities thanks to advances in psychology and the social sciences. Since the process outlined above continues to connect me with what is real, and since the spontaneous drive to inquire knows no limit, surely there are answers to my questions, even if they lie beyond my ability to comprehend. Since the world, as far as I'm able to ascertain, is fundamentally meaningful, surely things must ultimately make sense. I came to the conclusion that God, in the sense of necessarily existing being that explains the existence of the world that I know, must exist. In drawing this conclusion, I'm supported by others who've reached the same conclusion, and my conclusion is reinforced by my experience. But ultimately, it's based on the demands of intelligence and reason. Other people, atheists, choose differently. To my mind, in opting for atheism, they are conceding that the spontaneous dynamic drive of intelligence and everything we come to know as real are ultimately meaningless. Sometimes they appear to be rejecting a God that I too reject, a God that's too small, a God that is conceived in ways that offend reason. I'll come back to this shortly. Still others, agnostics, find the topic too difficult and choose to live their life without exploring the question of the existence of God. It seems to me that they can do this only by leaving aside too much of what makes life worthwhile and by not putting enough trust in the dynamism of the human spirit and its questioning and its quest for truth. And now, it's quite important to look, this will be interesting, I hope, at faulty concepts of God, because they're all around, including in my head. It's a big job to clear away rubbish that we connect with God. So I'm going to try to do it now as rigorously as I can. Don't cry, because I'm sure left over there'll be something very beautiful and pure. It'll be like a little, you know, a pearl in the middle of this bloody... What is a pearl?
Oyster.
Let's go. If you're ready to join me, here we go. There are many concepts of God that are handed down in the intimacy of the family and in public life of most cultures. These concepts arrive from our desire to make sense of experience. Some concepts express true insight and stand up to careful investigation. Others are the result of oversight and express a misunderstanding that upon careful reflection should be rejected. If we find accurate and inaccurate concepts in all other areas of human thinking, we shouldn't be surprised to find that concepts of God not only vary from culture to culture and from person to person, but that they represent a mixture of insights and oversights, understanding and misunderstanding. After all, our concepts of God aim to express our most profound insight into what reality ultimately is. No human concept can encompass God. The best we can do is to choose between contrary concepts, the one that expresses better our experience, and so points us better towards the reality that necessarily lies beyond our comprehension. We want our concepts to head us into the mystery, not head us away from the mystery. Head us into life with all its wonderful mystery, not away from life. People differ markedly in the meanings and values they associate with the term God. Because God is not just another thing or the sum of all things. Certain forms of Buddhism rightly conceive of God as no thing. Not nothing, but no thing. Because of the experience of relating to God in personal ways, Hindus, Christians, Muslims, and many others conceive God in personal terms. Because to say God is impersonal heads us away from our experience. To say personal, while it's an analogy and an imperfect concept when applied to God, heads us in a direction that makes sense to our life. In recent centuries, every concept of God has come under increasing suspicion. And this is a modern phenomenon. There was a time when the existence of lightning was taken as proof of the existence of the sky god, Zeus, and when the powerful, irrational feelings that seemed to take over our psyche were judged to be the result of the actions of vengeful, supernatural beings. We didn't take responsibility for our bad moods. There was some goddess. They always ended up being goddesses, these ones, but anyhow, who came in and drove me to it. Is this a dagger I see before my hand, etc. There was a time when victory in war was understood as proof of divine approval, while defeat demonstrated divine disapproval. And by the way, the Old Testament is shot full of all these concepts. Absolutely. So, no wonder Jesus had to say, it was said to you, but I say to you. He had to get across a concept of God that was so new to his contemporaries and to the world, really, and so beautiful. For good reason, such misconceptions have been rejected. If you win a war, it might be that you've got better ammunition, that you're more brutal, that you've lied more. You know what I mean? These could be the reasons. God say, don't blame Mary or God or some saint. The rejection, however, has gone so far that today God appears to some to be nothing more than a category invented to cover what we do not yet understand. With the methodical and cumulative acquisition of knowledge in many areas, some argue that the very idea of God is left over from a now unacceptable naivety. There's no doubt that certain conceptions of God are clearly erroneous. There's no doubt in my mind, anyhow. You check it for yourself. People rightly reject, inverted commas, God, who is envisaged as an extra, existing outside our world and history and experience, who controls things from the outside, as it were, and is directly responsible for whatever happens, intervening in history at will or in answer to prayer, understood as a magical power requiring a divine response. The history of religious experience, religious practice, in earlier times and still in our own day, frequently reveals a so-called God who is glorified at the expense of humanity. Some people seem to feel the need to put humanity down in order to raise God up. Brackets, jumping ahead. Jesus, one commandment to give you. Love God? No. Love your neighbour as I have loved you. It's so because he knew that if we're going to actually, John says that if you say you love God and don't love your neighbour, you're a liar. You've got God all bunged up. So get real. And you are loving God in loving your neighbour. Really. But we're not on Jesus yet. We'll come. Please, God. What is more, this God seems in large measure to be a projection of human need and human wishful thinking or human avoidance of the harshness of reality. People make religion a substitute for life. Rather than face up to reality, we seem to want to invent the kind of God to whom we can escape. Rather than face the here and now and do what we can about it, we seem to want to escape to a hereafter where everything will be as we wish things were here. There's no point in speaking of a God who doesn't require of us that we face the whole truth of our real limits, but also of the real greatness of being human. Any serious inquiry about God must be one that leads to a better understanding of and communion with our actual selves and our real world. We're rightly suspicious of a God who serves to support vested interests. We still hear God being used to support the ideology of military and economic victors over the vanquished. In God we trust. We still experience the rich and learned and those in positions of power of all kinds speaking and acting in the name of God when they're seen to be propping up their own position. We're all capable of doing this. Parents are capable of it. Grandparents are capable of it. Priests are in an absolutely vulnerable position to do this all the time. The second commandment we don't often confess, taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Well, imagine your job was to be a priest in the pulpit wanting to speak for God. If you say God says and God doesn't say, you've broken the second commandment. So be tough with us priests, but be very realistic about us and go for the jugular if you need to. But help us be humble. Since such a God is constantly being discredited, and we have no desire here to carry on the charade. Who can take seriously a God who supports apartheid or patriarchy? Or hypocritical piety, or a refusal to accept tried and trusted facts in any sphere. Galileo was much more attractive than the people who condemned him. The treatment meted out to Galileo in the name of God is more common than we might dare to admit. How many silenced theologians, dear, have we had this century? Some of them probably needed to be silenced. They were too bumptious and proud and didn't care on the effects. I'm not here to judge, but some of them were saying beautiful truths that needed to be heard. If there is value in talking about God at all, it can only be about a God in which everything participates, and therefore a God who supports the intrinsic and inalienable dignity of everything that exists. A God of truth. A God of justice. Freud worked with people with seriously dysfunctional psyches. Some of their religious attitudes were little more than a jumble of infantile illusions. His findings alert us to the need to to ask ourselves how free we are of such illusions. Let's be committed to name illusions when we are fortunate or diligent enough to discover them. Any claims we might make to relate to God, any claim, is worthless if our relationship fails to draw us on to maturity by clarifying our identity, deepening our intimacy, and enlarging our capacity for generating the love that provides the only environment in which we and others can grow. So, it's clear that all our concepts of God are precisely our concepts. They enjoy, therefore, all the strengths of human intelligence and imagination, but they also necessarily suffer from all the weaknesses. In recent centuries, some have gone beyond criticizing incorrect conceptions to reject any and every conception of God as unnecessary, unhelpful, and irrelevant in genuine human living and progress in knowledge. Others, while granting the need for constant refinement of our concepts of God, hold that the claim that God exists cannot be written off simply as human projection or distortion. They hold that the claim is based on an authentic, if often unreflective, response to real human experience and intelligent inquiry, and that there is a reality, albeit one upon which we cast our projections and which we distort. They see it as a fundamental and serious error to discard the real God along with our distorted concepts. Does rejecting the many false conceptions of God justify the rejection of a God who, while transcending every limited being and the whole universe of limited beings, is immanent in everything? Does it justify rejection of a God who is the ultimate reality in which everything real participates? The being that is the reason for anything making sense. The one who is constantly sustaining, inspiring, informing, and enlivening everything. Teilhard de Chardin speaks of God as the heart and the beyond of everything. Brackets. If our God, if anybody's God, is smaller than that, drop it. Because it's totally illogical and makes no sense. God must be the heart of everything. So this behavior of the Islamists, etc., is absurd in the name of God. The Christian, Jewish, Islamic, any religious group that fails to love in God's name is totally off beam. The heart, God is the heart of everything because everything is held in existence by God and is a radiance of God's being. The beyond, because the closer we get to the heart of anything, the more we are invited into mystery. Think of the person you're closest to, and they're the one who is most mysterious to you, because you've entered into the mystery through love. Whatever errors are present in the ways in which God is envisaged, the great religions of the world are right to continue to speak of God and to explore ways of relating to the ultimate reality in whom, as Paul says, quoting Epimenides, I think a Cretan poet of his of the 6th century BC, I think, the reality in whom we live and move and have our being. However we conceive God, our human words always fall short of the mystery of God. I'll take you slowly through this. It's quite profound, but ultimately absolutely Catholic and radical to everything I'm trying to share with you. The Catechism quotes St. Thomas Aquinas, who says, "We cannot grasp what God is, but only what God is not, and how other things stand in relation to God." Human concepts are adequate only within the range of our direct empirical experience. They are inadequate when we try to put words on religious experience. For as St. John reminds us, no one has seen God. Let all listen to St. Justin, a philosopher martyr of the 2nd century, who says, "The very name of God is not his name. For if anyone dares to claim that God has a name, he's mad." These words, Father, God, Creator, Lord, Master, they're not names. They're words to call him because of his goodness and works. The word God is not a name, but an approximation which we find natural when we attempt to explain the unexplainable. We've got to find a word. St. Gregory of Nyssa, one of the doctors of the Eastern Church, writing towards the close of the 4th century, has the same teaching. He says, and maybe we don't preach this enough, so we might get to the silly place where we think we know God and we can describe God and we can have concepts about God and get them right. Anyhow, Gregory says, "The teaching which Scripture gives us is, I think, the following. The person who wants to see God will do so in the very fact of always following God." Brackets, yesterday, beautiful feast of St. Mary of Magdala, my brother's ordination day, by the way. And Gregory the Great, Pope Gregory the Great, the end of the 6th century, has a lovely homily on Mary of Magdala. And the homily is, you know, she goes to the tomb, with the others are there, but they're not mentioned by John, because he wants to focus. And then she runs back and tells Peter and John, beloved disciple, they come running, find it all empty, go back home, she comes back with them and stays. And you know the rest of the story. And the beautiful point the Pope made was, she saw him because she didn't give up searching for him. The others had a look and went home, the boys, but not this woman. She kept searching, kept wanting. And this is all the saints tell us this. They've all got to be right. What Gregory of Nyssa is saying there, always searching is the only way to find. The contemplation of his face is an endless walking towards God. There's only one way to grasp the power that transcends all intelligence, not to stop, but to keep always searching beyond what has already been grasped. Which makes authentically held atheism such a tragic, sad thing. A tragic, sad thing, because somebody has set limits to the inquiry and left unquestioned real questions that need to be explored, like the ultimate meaning of life. We're not allowed to do that in the name of some knowledge that we've acquired in a small place that we may be an absolute genius at. But the questions that the human mind demands to explore have to be explored. And to write off the existence of God at the beginning of such a search is to jeopardize everything. St. Augustine, who'll always have something good to say in the 5th century, says, if you've understood, then it's not God. If you were able to understand, you would understand something else, but not God. If you were able to understand even partially, you've deceived yourself with your own thoughts. What I'm trying to do with you this morning is say, logic, honesty, inquiry, reason demand the existence of God for things to be. Once we start asking, what is God like? Well, then we're in the area of faith, belief, not inquiry, which of course, and we'll come to that, we're nearly finished here, the last one. Thank God for Jesus. All the Christian mystics say what Thomas Aquinas, Augustine, Gregory of Nyssa, and everyone else has said. I'll let John of the Cross, the 16th century Spanish mystic, speak for the mystics, and he says, marvelous, intelligent man, and Spaniards tell me the greatest lyrical poet in the Spanish language. And isn't it good when the greatest lyrical poet is a saint? God, if we were all saints, this would be such a beautiful world. However elevated God's communications and the experiences of God's presence are, and however sublime a personal knowledge of him may be, these are not God essentially, nor are they comparable to God, because indeed God is hidden in the soul. And he says elsewhere, since God is inaccessible, be careful not to concern yourself with all that your faculties can comprehend and your senses feel, so that you do not become satisfied with less and lose the lightness of soul suitable for going to God.